This Week in Cycling, a history of our wonderful sport for the discerning listener.
When we think back to the spring of 2009, the race that would come to mind for most people would be Milan-San Remo. That was the one where Heinrich Hausler shot out of the bunch with about 400 metres to go and looked for about 399 of those metres that he was going to become the first Australian to win it, until Mark Cavendish pipped him on the line. Hausler was riding for the brand new Cervelo test team, and although it seemed probable at the time, he would never go on to win a Monument Classic. But he was not the most prominent member of that team, who seemed like he should be capable of winning a Monument Classic, but never did. Tor Hushovd was also on that team. Hushovd won what amounted to a bunch sprint behind Cavendish and Hausler that day. He also finished third in Paris-Roubaix that year behind Tom Boonen and Filippo Pozzato. In 2010, he went one better and bagged a second place in the Hell of the North behind an unbeatable Fabian Cancellara. But again, like Hausler, second place was as good as it would ever get in the Monument Classics for Hushovd. He went on to win the rainbow jersey in Geelong at the end of 2010, but Hushovd now belongs on the unfortunate list of riders who could have and should have won a monument and never did, alongside the likes of Frans Verbeek, Freddy Martins and Greg LeMond. But Hushovd was also more than a classics rider, as his teammate and friend Jens Voigt explains in his autobiography, Shut Up Legs. You could see immediately that he was a good, strong rider and just needed a little help and advice. I mean, after all, he was world time trial champion as an amateur and just bubbling with talent. But what impressed me from the start with Tor was that despite how young he was, he had a real plan. When he was 18, he already owned a Porsche and a nightclub. He was always clever with money. He was sort of the picture book Viking. He was big and strong and possessed such acute mental focus. That was one of his nicknames, the Viking, and he lived up to it. He really was the god of thunder and lightning. He performed really well in the rain and descended like nobody else, maybe the best I've ever seen. Stuart O'Grady was probably as fast in the descent because he was just fearless, but Tor would take these corners so fast that it would take your breath away, and he would be like, oh, that was easy. We used to have this running gag where he would blow past me on a descent and then turn around and wave to me, come on, Jens, hurry up. But there was no way I could follow him on a descent. All I could do was wait until we started climbing the next mountain, and then I could ride alongside next to him and go, hey, you little fat sprinter, who's suffering now? We became such good friends on the team that I asked him to be my best man, along with Jens Wichmann, an old friend from sports school, when Stephanie and I finally got married in 2003. And what a champion. He had lots of results all the time. He was a great world champion because, well, he just kept winning, which doesn't happen often. More times than not, it's very hard for world champions to win many races because they're so marked with the rainbow jersey on their back. They just stand out. But Tor won two stages in the Tour de France and wore the yellow jersey that year. Talk about results. To me, he's one of the all-time greats. He was as strong as a horse, clever, fearless on the descents, and a very fast sprinter. Jens Voigt isn't wrong when he says winning two stages of the Tour and wearing the yellow jersey as world champion are fantastic results. But he is wrong to suggest that Hushovd wasn't affected by being marked due to having the rainbow jersey on his back. Having finished third and second in 2009 and 2010, arriving at the start line of the 2011 Paris-Roubaix with the rainbow stripes, Hushovd was one of the out-and-out favourites. His second place in 2010 was his best ever result, but he was never near Cancellara that day, nobody was. 2011 was the year that where Hushovd probably feels now was the one that he could have won. The results now state that he finished 8th, but that doesn't tell any of the real story. That he was a victim of the ultimate quirk of cycling, a team sport where one rider wins, and that day, his teammate won. A hollow victory for Hushovd. He would never get a better opportunity to take home a cobblestone.
Welcome to This Week in Cycling History. You know, Killian, I mean, I often look at riders and think, you know, they're back in the golden age, or I put on my rose-coloured spectacles and think back to Sean Kelly and Bernardino. But what really strikes me about this is Tor Hushovd is now drifting back into that class of rider who you remember fondly. For me, he still feels like a current part of the peloton, but he's been away 3 odd years.
Yeah, it's kind of a long time already, and those 3 years seem to happen quite quickly in my life anyway. I don't know about anybody else's, but yeah, he's been gone a few years now, and you know, he wasn't even at his best for the last couple of years of his career. He was pretty poor, actually, for the last couple of years. He was, I'm sure there was various reasons for that, but one of which was that he was picking up a nice paycheck at BMC, which is kind of where a whole generation of classics riders seem to go and not really achieve what they wanted, really. You know, I put Philip Gilbert in the same category and Alessandro Balan, and you know, there was a few others where they seemed to get a little bit comfortable. And Hushovd didn't really win major races for the last couple of years of his career, so maybe from that point of view it maybe even feels a bit longer since he was around. But you know, the best years of his career, I'd say, were 2009 till 2011, when he was at the Cervelo team, or Garmin Cervelo, or Garvelo, or whatever you want to call them. People are still calling them Garmin.
I still call them Garmin because I don't have the time to pronounce their full name now.
Well, I don't think anybody does. Even like, oh, geez, Well, I tell you what, that's another thing we can blame Lance Armstrong for, because he came up with the presented by first when he was U.S. Postal, presented by Barry Flores. That was the first team that ever had that. So now we're stuck with presented by Cannondale, is it?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, every time I look at it in the notes, my eyes just kind of glaze over. And I mean, it's ridiculously long. You've got to give your sponsors due recognition. But you know, let's do it in the jerseys, not in something that poor punters have to, or you know, pundits have to read out every week.
Yeah, even with 280 character tweets, it's not making it easy.
I tell you, the other thing that makes me feel really old is I've started recording with my chum Derek Troy, another Irishman. I'm blighted by you buggers. Again, and I stopped because it's a fun side project. You know, the Velocast and This Week in Cycling History and all that kind of stuff puts food on the table. I chat to Derek just because I like sitting down and chatting with Derek, and we recorded it and put it out. And I restarted it again because I thought we'd stopped a couple of years ago. We actually stopped the year that Hushovd, you know, didn't win Paris-Roubaix, you know, the race that you mention in the thing. And I remember Derek interviewing Jonathan Walters in the Flamcast and saying that he would have fucking killed him if it had been him, because he was so upset about Thor Hushovd not getting the chance to win the race, which I thought was an interesting interviewing technique. But the thing that really struck me is, I thought it was a couple of years ago, 7 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a long time.
I mean, we're just getting old now.
I know. I mean, just the fact that it's long ago enough that it's appearing on this history show says something. But it was a fascinating race. I rewatched it last night. I kind of a dumbed down highlights package on YouTube. I'll send out a link afterwards. But it's this kind of age old concept of the team over the rider, and the fact that this is a team sport won by individuals, as I mentioned in the piece. And this was like just a classic quintessential example of how that can play out, and how it doesn't always result in happy people, you know. And Thor Hushovd would have gone into that race, as I said in the piece, he had come third and second, and you know, as the progression goes, you would expect, or he probably would have been expecting to win, or certainly to be given the opportunity to challenge for the win, to sprint for that win. And he really wasn't. He was completely hamstrung almost from the get-go. I don't know how much you remember about that race, but Tom Boonen, it was billed.
No, I watched it yesterday again as well, actually, and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, like it was billed as kind of a Boonen-Cancellara showdown because maybe just to put a bit of context on this, because this all kind of, the reason this happened was because of what Fabian Cancellara did in the 2010 editions of the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, which was he just rode everybody off his wheel in both races, particularly in Paris-Roubaix. In the Tour of Flanders, he did as well. Up the Moor, which were the Moor van Gerardsbergen, which is, we're going to be treated to that as we speak this afternoon in the Omloop at Newsblad. But on that climb, Cancellara just dropped Boone, and there's a really famous clip of, you know, Boone kind of struggling to find another gear, literally kind of slipping through the gears, going, I can't keep up with this guy. Almost comes to a standstill on the bike as he changes gear, and Cancellara is just motoring.
Well, it's one of the clips that's often used in the Fabian Cancellara had a motor conspiracy theory thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's because it's similar with the Froome clip when he's flying up, I think it's Mont Ventoux around a corner, where, you know, just these seated attacks, which, so if there's a motor involved or not, whether you want to buy into those conspiracy theories, but regardless of whether there is or it isn't, a seated attack looks more unlikely to be physically possible than an out of the saddle attack. So anyway, this is what Cancellara's looked like. He didn't get out of his saddle. He just rode away from Boonen on that climb. And then in Paris-Roubaix the following week, it was almost more spectacular. It was with like 45, 50 kilometers to go. Boonen dropped back to the back of the group to get a bit of food, and Cancellara just, phew, just another gear.
Breaking
and,
my heart both times.
Yeah, for the Boonen lovers out there, yeah. It was hard to take for poor old Tom, although he did enough winning to make up for it. But that was 2010. It looked great as well because Boonen was in the Belgian champions jersey and Cancellara was in the Swiss champions jersey. It was just very, very striking imagery. But that was the context in which the whole peloton, the whole cycling season came to the 2011 classic season, where everybody was looking at Fabian Cancellara. This was kind of a new phenomenon almost, where, you know, Cancellara had to get used to this for the last 4, 5, 6 years of his career. But at that point, this was only getting started. Everybody following Cancellara everywhere. This was probably the first year of that because of what he had done in 2010. So in 2011 at the Tour of Flanders, it happened. I mean, we're about to talk about the Paris-Roubaix, but it also happened in the Tour of Flanders. Now, it was a different team kind of delivering the strange team tactic blow to Cancellara's hopes. It was Quickstep and Boonen. It was Sylvain Chavanel when he was at his kind of brief a couple of years at the Quickstep team. He was up the road in the Tour of Flanders, which meant Boonen, you know, couldn't really chase down. And so that gave Boonen almost a free pass to follow Cancellara. He, you know, the usual. Cancellara's turning around, arms in the air, giving out that nobody's working with him. And Boonen's able to just shrug and say, well, you know, my guy's up the front, so what do you want me to do? And I'm not going to work with you. And Cancellara got really annoyed and you know, he ended up chasing the breakdown himself, and such was the power and ability of Cancellara at that time. He was able to finish the race in second place, even though he was completely marked out of it for the whole thing. Nick Noyens ended up winning that Tour of Flanders. Sylvain Chavanel kind of faded a bit. But again, that was the context coming up to this 2011 Paris-Roubaix, where everybody was following Cancellara. And he's only himself to blame for a lot of the hype around him. Like, I was doing a bit of Googling there this morning, and, you know, some of the headlines that were being made before the day of the race was Cancellara saying stuff along the lines of, hold your breath for this race. I'm going to show you something special. You know, he was really shooting his mouth off that, you know, I'm going to do this again. You can't stop me, kind of thing. So, of course, people were going to mark him. But, you know, it happened again. Boonen kind of got taken out of the reckoning early on. He punctured some kind of mechanical anyway in the Arenberg Forest. There's kind of famous pictures of him as well, just waiting at the side of the road for minutes as Paris-Roubaix disappeared. At that point, he was trying to equal Roger de Vlaeminck's record of 4. He was still on 3. So the race just got away from him. We never really saw Tom Boonen again after the Arenberg Forest. But just after that point, as it often does, a move was made. Now, it's not always the move that makes it to the end, but a big move was made, and Johan van Summeren kind of got into it. Took him a while to bridge to a group of riders up front, but at that point, that's 100 kilometers to go, I think, is the Arenberg Forest thereabouts. And so van Summeren was in the front from that point, and from that point again, Hushovd, who's a teammate of Johan van Summeren, could just follow Cancellara, which maybe is what he was planning on doing anyway, and waiting for a sprint, I'm not sure, but it gave him a license to do that. And you know, I'm sure probably in the footage that you watched last night, there's with about 30, 35 kilometers to go, there's a bit of a lull in the race. There's the break that would make it eventually to not quite the velodrome, because van Summeren got there on his own, but the dribs and drabs that came in behind him was up the road, not that far up the road from Cancellara and Hushovd and Alessandro Bellan, who was there as well, the three of them. They're only about 35 seconds ahead.
It still looked catchable.
Yeah, especially in a race like Roubaix, when, you know, you do have, and for guys like Cancellara and Hushovd, which, you know, on a hard cobbled sector, they could eat up 20, 25 seconds on maybe riders who are up the front and tired, you know. So 35 seconds with 35 kilometers to go was really, you know, no big deal in a race like Paris-Roubaix. But at that time, there was a lull. You know, you could see them all kind of taking their hands off the handlebars, stretching their backs, getting a bit of food. And Cancellara went back to the team cars, but he didn't go back to his own team car. He went back to Jonathan Vaughters in the team car, you know, while gesticulating, arms in the air, you know, clearly giving out. And in the aftermath, it kind of came out that, you know, obviously Cancellara was complaining, like, you know, why doesn't your guy work? Come on. Like, he's the world champion. He's supposed to be trying to win.
It's a punter up the front. It's not even somebody that's going to win. You know, that's what Cancellara would have been saying. This isn't your guy. Johan Van Sumeren's up the front, but he's not a good enough rider to justify this kind of behaviour.
Yeah, and Hushaf kind of stayed a bit, you know, stoic on the bike. Didn't really converse with Vaders much. There was a couple of words exchanged, but I think it seemed at that point Tor Hushaft had resigned himself to his fate, that he was a pawn in this game now, and he wasn't going to be the guy that the race would evolve around, and it was too late, and all he could do from then was to keep following Cancellara, which is what he did. And again, amazingly, and a testament to the strength of the rider that Fabian Cancellara was at that point, he broke clear of the riders that he was with and got to the Velodrome and finished in second place. Sorry, I think he might have finished Tour of Flanders in third place, but he finished Paris-Roubaix in second place that day, despite of, you know, people following around all day. But again, like afterwards, you know, there was a good few interviews with Waters. I didn't listen back to the Derek one. I'd forgotten about that one, actually. But there was an interview on podiumcafe.com where, it might have been Derek. Did he used to have a nom de plume called Bikezilla?
No, I don't think so.
All right, maybe that was someone else. So I think
it would suit him, actually. I'll tell him that. He might like it.
Yeah. Bike silly, yeah. So he was interviewed by this guy anyway, and you know, Vaders was pretty pragmatic about it, you know, and he's all about the team. And
that was his thing with Derek, was it was all about the team, and the guy who was best placed would, you know, get the full support of the team, regardless of who it was. And to be fair, you can't take it away from Vaders; he's man one in the bloody day.
That's it. I mean, it is hard to argue. I mean, it's not like he took a gamble and Van Sumeren was beaten in a sprint by some other punter and it all blew up in his face. I mean, they won. They won the race as a team. But Vaders did say something interesting where he said that, you know, Van Sumeren was in this move with riders up front. I can't remember quite who the constitution of the break was. I know Manuel Quinziato was in there because he was on BMC and was a teammate of Alessandro Balan. So that's why Balan was in the group with Hushaft and Cancellara in the same boat as Hushaft, able to throw his arms up and say, well, I'm not working with you, Fabian, sorry about that. And but there was a group of four or five guys up front. And Vaders said in hindsight that, I suppose these things are easy to say in hindsight, but he did say that, he knew that Van Sumeren was not going to win a sprint against anybody, really. If he came into the Velodrome with anyone, he was going to lose a sprint. He was like, you know, Stein Vandenberg in that way. Just, he's not built for sprinting. He's
not built for Paris-Roubaix, to tell you the truth. When you look at him, he still physically is an extremely unlikely looking Paris-Roubaix winner for me.
Yeah, he's like 6'4", maybe. Yeah. Really, really one of the taller winners of the race, and kind of like a large
gangly lad.
Yeah, draped over his frame. He's kind of a strange looking on the bike, but he's not a sprinter. And Vaders said if he wasn't able to drop everyone, so the last tough cobble section that year, as it is most years, was the Mont-Saint-Pavel section. And he said to Van Sumeren over the radio that if you don't come out of there alone, I'm going to ask you to drop back to Tor Hushaft and help him come up for the sprint, because that's the only chance we're going to have of winning this race. You know, which is a kind of a damning thing to hear in the radio, you know, that there's the utter lack of confidence in your ability to tactically maneuver yourself into a way of beating anybody in a sprint. But, you know, maybe that was agreed upon beforehand. But that's what he said. He said if Van Sumeren hadn't have done what he did in the nick of time, the last possible moment that he really could have considered dropping all of those riders, that he would have been asked to drop back for Tor Hushaft, because at that point that would have been their only move left to win the race. But, you know, he did drop everyone. Hushaft was stuck behind, and that was that. And I suppose the whole thing was given an extra edge or an extra piece of context because Hushaft was in the rainbow jersey. And that's, I think, where particularly I remember Derek getting annoyed about it, was that you don't do this to the rainbow jersey, that, you know, he shouldn't be a pawn. He's not supposed to be plan B. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it worked out that day with Tor Hushaft.
An absolutely brilliant time trialist. And it's really interesting when you look at the comments prior to this classic season from Tony Martin, who's said that he's keen to go for Paris-Roubaix and is talking about how a time trialist has all of the capabilities to win the race. Hushaft, he won a prologue of the Tour de France, was national time trial champion umpteen times. And I think a lot of people just think about him as a sprinter. You know, because he was an awesome sprinter and had some great fights with Mark Cavendish for the green jersey. But there was far more to him than that. I mean, I remember that stage he won. Was he in yellow when he won that stage in the mountains in the Tour de France? And watching, you know, the big unit that was Thor Hushovd descending was a beautiful thing to see. So I can completely appreciate the comments that Jens Voigt is given in the piece that you did, because he was a bloody good all-round rider. I mean, he couldn't climb with the best just purely because of his size, but he was far, far more than just a pure sprinter.
Yeah, Jens Voigt's certainly not the only rider I've seen say that about Thor Hushovd, that he was by far and away the greatest descender of his peers at that time, that there was just nobody to touch him on the descents. People often said that about Fabian Cancellara as well. There's actually a great piece of footage of Cancellara, weaving in and out of the cars going down. I'm not even sure which climb it is, but during the Tour de France when he was, catching back on after something, it's a fantastic piece. It's terrifying.
It's beautiful because there's a display. You know, people often think all you do on a bike is turn the handlebars in the direction you want to go and lean, but there's a display of him just moving the bike with his hips and then counter steering. You know, turning the bar slightly the wrong way so that he's adjusting the angle of leaning the bike. It's a masterclass. We need to find that and post it in Twitch notes.
Yeah, it's really something else. And but Hushovd was like that as well. And I guess they always say, you know, that the sprinters are the best descenders because they have to be to catch up with the race constantly. You know, they can't afford to be left behind. And this is their opportunity to gain back time they lost on the way up the climb, is to gain it back on the way down. But yeah, loads of riders have said that about Thor Hushovd. And you just wouldn't see it. You wouldn't often see him descending a mountain. Because sure, why would you? Why would they be focusing on him on the front of a mountain stage of the Tour de France? But like you say, he was versatile. He was actually world under 23 time trial champion. And you know, at that point in your career, there's always a kind of a scramble to pigeonhole you when teams come to sign riders. They're trying to fill a gap in their roster. And it's, if you're looking for a time trialist or somebody who's going to give you a pack a bigger punch for the team time trial for a Grand Tour or something, you know, these are the types of guys that you would come to look at, riders who've done well in the world under 23 time trial championships. It's only natural. And Thor Hushovd won it. But he was a lot more than that. But something I have here to mention in the notes is that, you know, he's not the only time trialist that has morphed himself into a sprinter. Marcel Kittel actually started life as a time trialist as well. Maybe people mightn't realize that. He didn't win the under 23 time trial championships, but he finished third one year, Marcel Kittel, beating the likes of, he's kind of on a par in terms of age with Alex Dowsett, Tom Dumoulin, he beat that year, Rohan Dennis, you know, serious time trial, the best of the best of time trialists now. And Kittel was beating him in his early 20s, but, you know, changed tactic and became a sprinter. And that's what Thor Hushovd did as well. Certainly in the early years in his career, Hushovd, I mean, he was a sprinter really during his Crédit Agricole years. And then he kind of morphed into much more classics leaning rider eventually in his later years. But I mean, very kind of versatile. And I suppose the reason that he came to mind, and the reason that I ended up, I kind of get lost myself when I decide to do a piece about a particular rider and which unit of their career I should focus on. I just ended up on the 2011 Paris-Roubaix, but the reason he came to mind was because he is, of course, a previous winner of Het Nieuwsblad in 2009. Actually, I started off the piece by mentioning the 2009 season where Heinrich Hausler lost Milan Sanremo to Mark Cavendish, but just a few weeks before that, on kind of, you know, the team's classics debut, this was a brand new team, with Carlos Sastre, reigning Tour de France champion, was their marquee rider, but they had quite a formidable classics team as well, not just Hushovd and Hausler. This was their debut in the race, and I didn't look back at the footage of that race, but I seem to remember. You know when Ian Stannard mugged Omega Pharma Quickstep a few years ago at Het Nieuwsblad? Yeah, that was fantastic. Three on one, and Stannard beat them.
But it was really special classics guys on one. No, three punters on one.
Yeah, Tom Boonen and Nicky, two Paris-Roubaix winners, and Stijn Vandenberg. Yeah, absolutely, you know, cream of the crop there, and Stannard mugged them. It wasn't quite as bad in the 2009 Het Nieuwsblad, but I do remember Rabobank absolutely dominating that race and completely failing to to maneuver themselves into a position to win it, that they just completely fell apart and made a mess of it. And Hushovd ended up coming round a break, which almost made it to the finish, I think, but Hushovd kind of mugged him in the end and won that race. So yeah, he's a former winner of Het Volk, as it was, still was then, I think, rather than Het Nieuwsblad. But yeah, as I said in the piece, I think certainly a rider who will go down as a guy who should have and well could have and probably should have won a Monument Classic and never quite managed it.
I'm loath to say this given his palmarès, which is, you know, it's extremely long. He won an absolute bucket load of stages in, you know, the biggest races. He came very, very high up in things like, you know, Paris-Roubaix, won a whole bunch of world and national titles and, you know, their attendant jerseys. But do you think he was maybe just a bit too lazy? Because I mean, it is a terrible thing to say, but it's that BMC thing. You know, riders went to BMC, they got the massive salaries from Andy Rees, and it seemed to take some of the fire out their belly. I mean, you only need to look at the difference between Philippe Gilbert pre and post BMC compared to BMC era Philippe Gilbert. And Hushovd, in that tour, that Paris-Roubaix, when I was watching it, you're right, there's a point where if Hushovd and Cancellara had decided to work together, I have no doubt whatsoever they would have bridged up to that front group. And at that point, he's in with a win. You mentioned Bernardino in the notes as a comparison, and I think you're spot on. A Bernardino would never have let a teammate like Van Someren win the race. He just would have gone, this is mine. Team orders can be, you know, disregarded because I've decided I'm going to win this and take off. And I think Hushovd was good enough to win loads of stuff, but he maybe just lacked that final 2% of mental aggression that is the mark of the true great, as opposed to the amazingly good rider who's got a really good palmarès, but maybe was a bit disappointing compared to what you would expect.
Well, I suppose the comparison with Eno as well is relevant because Eno is still the last rider to have won Paris-Roubaix in the rainbow jersey. And you know, it's not often that a rider who is capable of winning Paris-Roubaix wins the World Championships. It happens from time to time, but, you know...
it's happened for the last 3 years, hasn't it?
Well, that's true, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's become more normal. Peter Sagan is making the ridiculous more normal every year, but, you know, it's one every few years, I guess, on average, that we would get to the start of Paris-Roubaix where there is, first of all, the rainbow jersey's there, which doesn't always happen. And second of all, that you think, yeah, you know, this guy is actually a favourite for this race. And plus added in the fact that he'd come so close to the two previous years and that he was, you know, he was one of the favourites for this race. He was at the peak of his powers in, with regard to his own age and his career and how he had progressed. And it was just this day that was supposed to be his. And yeah, you make a good point that, you know, maybe he just, you know, this is a topic that's come up a few times in the last few weeks with us, you know, much more in the context of the Tour de France. We talked about Chris Froome in the 2012 Tour de France, and he didn't take that opportunity to, you know, twist the knife on Bradley Wiggins. And there's been a few kind of things like that in Grand Tours where teammates could have but ultimately didn't do over their own teammate. In a classic, I think it would be much more, maybe acceptable is the wrong word, but in hindsight, maybe accepted if a rider was to do it, because it's just one day and you don't get this, like, you don't get the kind of the post-mortem after every single stage of 3 weeks worth of Grand Tour racing the way you do in the Tour de France in a classic. You know, you do it, you ride it, and then it's done, and you don't really have time to dwell on it because now everybody's looking forward to the next one. And I think it would have become much more accepted if Hushovd had said, you know what, I can't be doing with this, and just said, all right, come on Fabian, let's go. And you know it would have been frowned upon at the time, but I think, you know, we would have been marveling now at a show, on a show like this, looking back, wasn't that fantastic that Hushovd did that, and he won Paris-Roubaix in the rainbow jersey. And if he hadn't have done that, he would have, you know, maybe his team would have won. But what a shame that would have been if the rainbow jersey had faded to eighth, and just for the sake of the team. And I'm sure we would have been marveling at a move like that. And, you know, what a man to have the balls to make a move like that when he was stuck in that position. But instead, you know, he didn't. And you know, people do talk about the fact that he's such a nice guy. Now, I know that that doesn't automatically translate to how you ride on a bike. There's loads of nice guys in real life that are animals.
Stab you in the back in competition.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, I'm sure there are examples of riders that, you know, can't help but exude their everyday persona on a bike the way they would just, you know, in conversation. And perhaps Hushovd is one of them. Maybe he didn't have that mean streak that he needed. But like, looking back on his career as well, just for the final few years, like 2011, I don't even think you would put in the category of top seasons for him. He didn't really have a good season that year. That was probably he won two stages. What am I talking about? He won two stages of the Tour de France. I mean, in terms of classics,
yeah.
He did, like, the eighth in Paris-Roubaix was as good as it got that year. And he didn't really feature in any of the other classics, really. And after that, he made that move to BMC, and he didn't get another top 10 in a monument, for sure. He didn't really feature that much at all for BMC. And they, at that time, they've kind of changed their tactic now. They're much more of a Grand Tour team now, with Richie Porte and TJ Van Garderen. And you know, I know they had Cadel Evans at that time, but they were really focused on the classics. They had assembled this all-star team of current and former world champions. They had Alessandro Balan. They had Cadel Evans, who was a world champion as well. They had Tor Hushovd and Philippe Gilbert. They had Manuel Quinziato. I think they have Daniel Oss at that time as well. They just had a lot of serious contenders for these races. They had George Hincapie as well, actually. They had a lot of a really top classics riders, and maybe it was just, you know, too many cooks spoil the broth type stuff, and they just never got it together. And certainly Hushovd didn't. He never really featured in the classics for BMC, and his, like I said, his career kind of fizzled out. The end of his career was interesting, actually. I remember talking to you about this before, where he was coming to the he didn't quite finish his career in Norway, but the Arctic Race of Norway was one of his final races. He came back and did a small stage race in France, and then I think his last race was like the GP Van Petegem or the GP Pinot-Cerami or one of them, but it was a tiny Belgian race. But one of, you know, his kind of farewell to the sport was in Norway at his home, and it was the final stage, which was expected to be a sprint, and Alexander Kristoff was there and in good form, and you know, he had won the Tour of Flanders that year. Had he won the Tour? Sorry, he won Milan San Remo that year, and you know, he was at the top of his game. And I remember it was actually a tweet by Shane Stokes, actually, which triggered this thought. Can't actually remember what he said, but you know, the goal of a rider on a team is to get the best exposure possible for that sponsor.
Rolling billboards.
Yeah, and usually, you know, more often than not, 99.9% of the time, the way to do that is to win a race, but this seemed like an exception where, you know, I hesitate to say that they would have fixed the race. But, you know, if Kristoff had have feathered the brakes and let Hushovd win that race, you know, that would have been a much bigger story to say, you know, farewell to Tor. You know, wasn't it great that he won his final race? And, you know, let's all have a big party because Tor Hushovd is retiring, rather than Kristoff ruins Hushovd's day, and then the next day everybody moves on and forgets about it. Instead, we would have been talking now about, you know, Tor Hushovd won his final race in Norway, you know, beating his kind of successor. You know, was how fantastic was that? But, you know, it didn't happen, and Kristoff won, and you know, everybody forgot about it the next day. So it was kind of a shame for Tor Hushovd for it to have fizzled out in that way. But you know, his career kind of did fizzle out in general, so maybe it was fitting.
Yeah, and it may have been, I mean, what's it, mononucleosis or whatever he had. He had a viral problem for the last couple of years, apparently, which we have to mention because that might have been the reason. But while we're playing what ifs, see if he'd won that Paris-Roubaix. I think he would have gone on to win another, at least a Milan-San Remo or something. You know, we talk often about sprinters and confidence, and we've seen how often once somebody wins one monument, they'll start to, you know, they'll start to consider themselves a contender, and they'll take themselves more seriously in other monuments. I really think Thor could have had a palmarès that eclipsed even his fantastic one that he's already got. I will say though, I think he's one of those riders who's just got the perfect name, hasn't he? I mean, you look at him and he looks like a Thor.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like a caricature of a Scandinavian warrior almost. I mean, it's just a great name. And I miss him from the peloton. He was always quite entertaining and always good for a quote because he was such a nice guy. Everybody's heard of Thor Hushovd. Let's go into the next piece, which is, it's about a bloke that likely none of you have heard of.
There's a section in Andy McGrath's award-winning book Bird on the Wire, a biography of Tom Simpson, where he tackles the topic of doping in cycling head-on, the circumstances of Simpson's death, and how doping was viewed at that time. McGrath writes, "It would have been nice if Tom Simpson's death served as a wake-up call which provoked necessary soul-searching, changed methods from riders, and the introduction of stringent measures from the sport's governing body. But this is professional cycling, not some schmaltzy Hollywood ending. The sport can often be more cruel or puzzling than it is beautiful. Its askew moral compass wasn't going to jokingly correct itself after decades of wonkiness." Colin Lewis alleges that the day after Simpson's death, as the grief-stricken peloton stood on the start line in Carpentras, he saw amphetamine pills in the jersey seam of French star Jean Stublinski. A week later, following the pivotal Puy de Dôme stage, Tour de France runner-up Julio Jimenez admitted, "I took stimulants, but everybody did, like me. It was the last chance to try and take the yellow jersey from Roger Penjan. Everyone gulps down pills. We are all guilty in the same way." It kind of acted as a wake-up call, but not really. They labelled the 1968 Tour the Tour of Renewal and made the route so easy that a rider like Jan Janssen was able to take the victory. But if cycling was looking for a wake-up call, Simpson's wasn't the first death which should have acted as a catalyst. In 1961, a rider suffered an almost identical fate to Tom Simpson. Herbie Sykes posted a photo of him on Twitter last year and eloquently described how his death was greeted in the sport of cycling. "This is poor Bruno Busso. He died of heatstroke, amphetamine, heart attack at the 1961 Tour of Piedmont. Nobody gave a flying fuck." He was 30 years old, slightly older than Simpson. But perhaps this death should have been more striking. Simpson had drugs in his body as a rider who was trying to win, who regularly did win. But Busso died with amphetamines in his system as a rider just trying to get by, just trying to keep up. He was taken to hospital and he died the following morning. His brother Arturo gave statements to the press that Bruno had a tube of tablets on him, which he was ingesting during the race. Some tried to dismiss his death as a man who was simply pushing his body too hard, beyond its limits, and that Busso simply didn't have the capacity to be a cyclist. However, whenever he could reach the mountain slopes of the Val d'Aosta near his home, he took part in strenuous skiing. He was in the army in the 10th Mountain Artillery Regiment, participating in summer and winter alpine troops. This was not an unfit man. He died because of the cocktail of drugs in his body, combined with the extreme heat that day at the Giro del Piedmont, the same as Tom Simpson on Mont Ventoux 6 years later. But as Herbie Sykes said, nobody cared. Nobody did anything about it. Least of all the UCI, who had no appetite to address these problems in 1961. They barely have any appetite to address these same problems now in the 21st century. As usual with the UCI, as it always has been, they were then and are now more interested in a scandal-free sport rather than a doping-free sport.
It's really funny. I mean, one thing I've learned about this sport in the years we've been doing this together, Killian, is that there are, for every star, there are hundreds of riders that even somebody who's obsessed with the sport like myself just hasn't heard about. And Bruno Busso is one of those. And it's amazing to me when you look at how close that death was to the tragic loss of Tom Simpson and Mont Ventoux, that the two aren't inextricably linked in everybody's mind, and that he's not mentioned. I mean, you mentioned at the end of your piece that he's not mentioned in any of the Tom Simpson biographies that you've read.
Yeah, I don't want to make this as a criticism of the authors of these books, but it just surprises me that this didn't end up in any of these books. I mean, I've got Bird on the Wire by Andy McGrath, where I took a quote from at the top of the piece. That's the most recent one. Very good. I mean, I say award-winning. It won William Hill Sports Book of the Year, which is kind of the highest prize in the land for a sports book. Won that last year. There's Jeremy Whittle's book Ventoux, which isn't necessarily, it's not a Tom Simpson biography, but of course there is a lot of Tom Simpson biography in there. Bruno Busso doesn't get a mention there, and then there's William Fotheringham's one, which is the go-to biography, I guess, of Tom Simpson, called Put Me Back on My Bike. And now I say Bruno Busso doesn't get a mention. I didn't read all of them all the way through again over the last week. They have indexes, and Bruno Busso is not mentioned. So I kind of, if he is in there and I'm wrong, then apologies. But he's not mentioned in the indices, and you would imagine that he would be if he was in there. But he doesn't appear to me that he is. And like you say, just the stories are so similar, and you know, I suppose there is a rider who kind of gets mentioned as some kind of portent to what happened to Tom Simpson, and that rider's name is Jean Malajac. I think we might have spoken about him before years ago on the show. He collapsed on Mont Ventoux, so I suppose it's only natural that you would draw the comparisons, in 1955, which is a good few years before Simpson. That was 12 years before Tom Simpson collapsed on Mont Ventoux. Now, Malajac didn't die. He kind of had one of those episodes. Do you remember there was a, was it a Moroccan rider, Abdel Zaf, I think his name was, way back in the Tour de France, where the story was that he was found at the side of the road, and then he got back on his bike and started cycling the wrong way, and he was really, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. Now, that's it. I mean, maybe we'll get onto that in a minute, but with Zaf, the story was that he had just been drinking alcohol. With Jean Malajac, it was a much more potent cocktail of drugs that was, I guess you'd need to still say alleged, that was to be in his body, because he denied it to his death. I think he died in the year 2000 or 2001, and he always maintained that, you know, he hadn't taken anything, but I think whoever was his entourage at the time would have said otherwise. And so he collapsed on Mont Ventoux, and, you know, was delirious. I think he actually went unconscious for a few minutes. He woke up, he didn't know where he was. He was, you know, he was in a really bad way. Now, he didn't die, but it was, it should have been some kind of wake-up call for someone somewhere, but it just didn't appear to rattle any cage whatsoever. But yet we have Bruno Busso, which was 6 years on from Jean Malajac, 6 years before Tom Simpson, and he did die. And now, it wasn't in a high-profile race like the Tour de France. It wasn't on a high-profile climb like Mont Ventoux. It was in the Giro del Piedmont, which maybe people haven't heard of. It's actually a strange race. It kind of comes and goes. It's had financial difficulties over the last while. I don't think it took place last year. I'm not sure if it's due to take place this year. But it's, you know, it's a minor Italian race. And this was a guy who was, you know, we kind of spoke before we started recording about, you know, bits and pieces that you might find about this guy on the internet, and there is none. There's a Wikipedia page on him, which is literally just one line to say that he was born and he died. And then there's a, you know, one of the go-to websites for me for historical results is cyclingarchives.net. I'm sure I'm not alone in that. I think it's actually Dutch originally. It's called De Wieler site. And
nothing there either.
He's there. He was born. He died. And no results. None. No listing of any results. So this is a guy that, you know, wouldn't have been to the forefront of people's minds then. Never mind now. But, you know, he was in a UCI race, which was, you know, under the umbrella of the sport of cycling. And there's, you know, a duty of care there that was just completely ignored. Now, I know Herbie Sykes kind of, you know, as I quoted him in the piece, you know, he obviously said that nobody cared that this had happened. I think that's slightly unfair. I did look
also
back.
That's not exactly what he says.
That's not exactly what he said. No, yeah, he's. Yeah, his quote was a bit harsher than that. He wrote a very good piece. I'm sure he was researching this piece at the time when he sent this tweet. The kind of the times add up. But he wrote a piece which was originally produced in Swan Year magazine. But they've been kind of periodically releasing old articles. I say old, like within the last 6 months or 2 years maybe worth of journal publications that they have. Swanier is kind of a ruler-y type journalist, really, really good. But they have a great website as well, where they've been releasing some articles from past issues. And this was one of them, where Herbie Sykes, he's writing about all kinds of things, but it's very sweary and it's very interesting. And in the end, he talks about, he just mentions in passing Bruno Busso dying, and it kind of went hand in hand with that tweet. But that was it. Like, you know, that's all the information you get, even from Herbie Sykes. And, you know, I'm sure he did his own research, but I did mine. And I found there's an old internet archive called La Stampa, which is an old Italian newspaper, and very searchable. It's very good. Now, extracting text from it and trying to get translations is another story. It's a little bit cumbersome to do that, but, you know, I put a bit of time in and managed to do it. And at the time, there were people, you know, asking questions, journalists, family members, doctors, soigneurs, you know, they were saying, you know, how did this happen? Because we need to learn. Like, I've got a quote here. It says, now this is the journalist writing.
Yeah, no, that's good to thank you, because this particular quote led to me seeing a lot of boxing this morning before we sat down to record.
I know, yeah, sorry about that. Again, the translation can be a little bit cumbersome. So instead of Bruno Busso, I pasted in the quote, and Busso translates as the word knock.
Yeah, so I got Mike Tyson, you know, knocking three bells out of Frank Bruno on numerous occasions.
Yeah, another angle to the ungoogleable nature of Bruno Busso. But the quote here written by the journalist is, "The cause of death of Bruno Busso must be resolved without uncertainty, since that's the only way you will be able to adopt measures which would in the future safeguard the lives of other young athletes. Abuse of chemicals, heart failure and circulatory from exertion, sunstroke aggravated by physical debilitation after 200 kilometres of racing. These are the questions that we asked yesterday to doctors involved in the case. The responses were inevitably evasive. Maybe all three factors, and maybe, who knows, some other factors." So at the time,
56 years ago, they said that you could say that about some of the races we've seen that led to the extreme weather protocol in the last couple of years.
And that's it. And so we're, you know, that's, I mean, I can't remember how long ago did this extreme weather protocol come in. It's only 2 years ago, maybe. Yeah. It's very recent. And yet this was happening back then, and questions were being asked. Now, it's, I suppose, maybe Herbie Sykes' point was that the appetite to follow up on these questions was just not there, and nobody cared enough to warrant follow-ups and to, you know, kick a few stones around in the offices of the UCI to say, come on, you need to do something about this. Now, obviously, at the time, the focus probably wouldn't have been on extreme weather. That's where we're at now. But it would have been maybe, or should have been, at the products that these guys were taking. But at the time, they weren't banned. You know, there was no tests.
It wasn't just that they weren't banned. They were widely accepted. I mean, that's the whole thing. We think that doping in the sport is bad just now. Mm. Back then, I mean, people were openly talking about the stimulants they took, you know, the weird stuff they did to try and enhance their performance. And also, cycling wasn't the high-profile sport that it is now. You know, it was a working man's sport, a way, and it's still a cliche, a way to get out of the mines, for example. You know, you go and watch Paris-Roubaix, before the Arnberg Forest starts, the thing that dominates it is the big lift wheels of the mines. And these were guys that were coming out of a working-class background, and cycling wasn't a way to get rich like football is now, or football probably was even then. It was a way to get a better wage than a manual labourer.
And like, that was a point I was going to make. Now, I make this point with a little bit of a grimace, because I'm not entirely sure if I'm right. Maybe people can correct me if I'm not. But it seems to me, from everything I've read, or, you know, around this era and the state of cycling at that time, was that, like you say, it was considered, you know, a job, first of all. You know, it wasn't glamorous. It was just a way of putting food on the table, if that, for a lot of people. And, you know, perhaps if somebody died doing this, maybe it was considered, you know, like a miner dying down a coal mine. It wasn't, not that it wasn't a big deal. Obviously, the family are going to be devastated, and close friends. And of course, there's going to be mourning involved for some people. But in general, the wider public, you know, if somebody dies doing this, you know,
it's a tragedy, but it's the cost of doing business.
That's it. It's expected. And I guess, I mean, it's easy for somebody as young as me to kind of forget, or to not even realize what life was like back then. But this isn't long after World War II. It's only 15, 16 years after it finished. So people have maybe not numb to death, but had certainly become more used to it than anybody should be. And that this was just another young man dying, you know, doing something that was physically exhausting. And, you know, I do mention in the piece that, you know, it was suggested that, you know, he was a cycling nobody, and that, you know, maybe he shouldn't have been trying to ride these races in this weather. And but, you know, there was kind of a rebuttal to that, you know, he actually was really fit, and he was in the army, and, you know, he went kind of cross country skiing whenever he could. And, you know, as we know, we've spoken about VO2 maxes and that, to do cross country skiing, you need to be incredibly fit as a professional cyclist. And, you know, so that excuse didn't really wash. But, you know, again, if you're going to decide you're going to become a cyclist, that maybe, you know, these are occupational hazards. And again, going back to what Herbie Sykes said, you know, just this is, again, leads to the fact that nobody cared. And again, caveat that with, you know, generally nobody cared that this happened. And this is why there was no kind of bolt of lightning striking the UCI saying, oh God, we have to do something about this, because What would they do? You know,
I hate to say it's probably an earlier example of the classic dilemma they have about the image of the sport, you know, promotion of the sport versus the governance. Because if they had got stuck into this, it would have made drugs a far higher profile issue much, much earlier, which would have been an absolute handful for them.
And it caught up with them shortly after this. I mean, a lot of it did have to do with Tom Simpson dying. But maybe just to mention one other writer as well, which again, Herbie Sykes mentioned in his piece. I think he might have done a full feature on this team time trial team in pro cycling on his retro column a few years ago. I might dig that out. But there was a Danish team time trial team in the Rome Olympics. That would have been 1960. So just less than a year before Bruno Busso died, there was a rider called Knud Enmark Jensen, who was a member of the Danish team time trial team. And again, he was, his was a little bit more kind of a mechanical death, because he did have a body filled with all kinds of things, amphetamines and that type of thing. But because he was fueled with this stuff, he collapsed on his bike. And as a result, he hit his head and fractured his skull. So it was a kind of a more, you know, like a mechanical death, but it was
drugs were the contributing factor as opposed to the direct cause.
Exactly, yeah. And so that happened in 1960. Bruno Busso happened in 1961. Then Tom Simpson happened in 1967. And it was only, I think it was in 1965, that doping actually became against the rules. You know, there was no anti-doping before that. It wasn't a thing. Nobody cared. It wasn't anything that anybody cared about. And like, even as late, I just read this morning, like even as late as the 1930s, Henri de Grange printed in the rules of the Tour de France that doping products wouldn't be given out by the organizers. Yeah, you know, that was the reality. That was the context. Now, that was a few decades before, but I mean, that's what you're coming from, where, you know, there was a point where maybe riders did expect the organizers to be dishing out products to them.
You go back to the doctor's car and it's no for some second skin and a bandage.
That's it, yeah. They are, you know, handing them out like sweets. So it wasn't until 1965 that they actually realized, you know, maybe this isn't a good idea and we should make this against the rules. It wasn't until the following year that the first tests were introduced in 1966. Now, I presume they were very rudimentary and they were very challengeable, and they were challenged at almost every turn. You know, riders would pick holes in the process and say, you know, that's a false positive for, you know, any number of reasons. And riders, you know, they succeeded in this. You know, I suppose
that sounds quite familiar.
Yeah, it's what Chris Froome is going through at the moment. But it was a lot easier to argue your false positive 50 years ago than it is now. And riders,
the thing is, even if you were caught, you go, you know, 10 minutes time added to your overall for a Grand Tour, and, you know, a slap in the wrist and a 1 week suspension or something.
Yeah, that's it. Like, I mean, you know, riders did get suspended that time for various things. I can't remember who it was. Jacques Anquetil, it sounds like something Anquetil would do, where he actually did get banned for a month, but instead just ignored it and raced anyway. And on the first day of his ban, and then eventually the UCI muttered something about, oh, well, maybe the procedure wasn't right. So they lifted the ban, and that was that.
Yeah.
So he just completely flaunted it. And again, nobody cared. And we've gone through before, there was a series of positives in the Giro, in the aftermath of Eddie Merckx. Eddie Merckx testing positive in 1969 in the Giro would have been probably the highest profile case up until then. But it was at that point that the UCI really decided that they weren't interested in doping free. They were only interested in scandal free. And that's when they kind of curbed this rise of outrage when somebody tested positive, and they really tried to dampen down. Yeah. You know, this is like you said, this is just a slap on the wrist, just a time penalty. You know, no big deal. Let's move on, and that's what it was for 20-30 years, even until really.
Well,
think back
to, you know, almost exactly 30 years later to another Tour of Renewal, when they just allowed the backdated TUE for Armstrong's cortisone.
That's it. You know, it was ever thus. You know, we always get these fault stones. And, you know, whenever anybody says that we're in a new era of clean cycling, you really have to take it with a pinch of salt. And I guess that whole image is being tested again now. Now, I must predicate that with the fact that, you know, we're not talking about blood transfusions in EPO anymore, really. Now, there are...
Well, no, for the top guys, the punters are still doing EPO.
I know, which kind of makes you think, well, if they're doing it, who else is doing it? It's very hard to accept that... were kind of moved on in any significant way. I'm sure it's changed, but are we any better off? I'm not sure. But at least, you know, now that when things happen, there are reactions. You know, we have had, and sorry, you mentioned Chris Horner at the very top, and we said we'd re-mentioned this, where, you know, there was the very distressing footage, and I'll try and find this and tweet it as well. Now, it's not really something that...
It's not pleasant watching, it really isn't.
No, it's very distressing. I can't even remember what race it was. I'm sure it was in America. It was probably the Tour of California or the old Tour of... Georgia, maybe, or I can't quite remember, but it was Chris Horner riding for Radio Shack, and Johan Brunel was his director sportif, and Chris Horner comes across the finish line, and he's no idea where he is. He's no idea what's just happened. He crashed, and he got back on his bike, and he rode a significant amount of kilometers. It was 20 or 30. It was a lot, like, and he had no memory of just doing that. He couldn't remember being on his bike. He didn't know where he was. He barely knew his own name. And it was because he had a serious concussion. Yeah. But he was put back on his bike and he was allowed to finish that race. And it's really only now in the last... Well, we still haven't gotten there, but only in other sports now that they're taking concussion seriously. You know, there's been a series of movies, really.
Will Smith's made a film about it.
Yeah, called Concussion. And there's been a series of documentaries, high profile documentaries about this problem in American football, in the NFL. And it's becoming a real hot topic in rugby, with this protocol of checks that you need to do on a rugby player when he is suspected of having concussion on the pitch. Now, it's still not perfect. It's not perfect at all, but I mean, at least it's something. And even just this past week, Cavendish crashed in the neutral, well, just after, well, it was the neutralized zone in the Abu Dhabi Tour.
And, one place where technology doesn't help cycling. Apparently, it was the pedestrian detection that set the braking off in the commissaire's car.
What a cock-up that was. I mean,
absolutely horrible to watch as well.
You know, I was like kind of joking on Twitter, but I mean, I kind of floated the point that, you know, surely it's not beyond the realms of possibility that Cavendish could consider legal action against the race organisers. Now, I know he's an ambassador for that race, which puts him in a bit of an awkward position. But if he's got concussion, I mean, it's a serious injury, and people are only realizing how serious. Like, actually, you know, the Irish rider Eddie Dunbar, the young rider, he suffered a concussion. Was it in the Tour de l'Avenir, or I can't quite remember what race, but it was in July or August of last year, and the decision was made for him to stop racing for the rest of the year. For 6 months he stopped racing, which,
and think about, you know, that at this stage in Cavendish's career.
And that's it. So, like, if Cavendish was to stop racing for I mean, one concussion at this time of Cavendish's season could ruin his entire year. And I really don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that if Cavendish has a bad year for that team, and that contributes to that team having a bad year in general, that team might end. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's how precarious cycling is in general.
Oh, look at Astana. Well, we're hearing now that the Kazakhs have just not paid them, so they're not paying their staff. They're using their, you know, their reserves to get to races and that kind of thing. So even a team with a profile like Astana, breaking last night, talking about it to folk this morning, there's a genuine chance they could go under.
That's it. It's so fickle. It's really just you're on thin ice constantly. And so I really don't think it is beyond the realms of possibility that if Cavendish, you know, doesn't win a race for this year, or a major race for this year, that, you know, the sponsors would question what they're doing. And you know, this all could stem from this guy's braking system in the Abu Dhabi Tour causing this. So if I, you know, if I was the team, if I was Cavendish, you know, I don't think I would be ignoring the legal avenue, because it's got serious consequences. But we've gone off on a tangent there, but it's
just for change.
I suppose, well, yeah, but I suppose the point is that we are in a position now where the UCI have taken steps. You know, we do have the extreme weather protocol, anti-doping, regardless of what people think of it and its inadequacies, which it is inadequate. I don't think it'll ever be considered adequate, but at least it's
something.
At least anti-doping is a thing now, whereas it wasn't back then. And again, to parrot Herbie Sykes' original point, you know, in 1961, when something like this happened, really nobody cared.
Yeah, and that's one thing that has changed. I mean, we do care now. I mean, I remember being in the shop in Edinburgh the day that Fabio Casartelli lost his life, and it was before, you know, Twitter, and before we got to see every kilometre of every stage. So there was the, you know, the kind of fog of war confusion about whether it was Casartelli or Casagrande were the two riders that were being mentioned. And then the shock once we got home and saw the footage. I think everybody who listens to us, even if they're relatively new to the sport, will remember, you know, the horrifying death of Wouter Wieland. So people do care now. You know, it's not a situation where it is just the cost of doing business. There have been strides with the UCI taking their part in that. So although I'm happy to batter them for their conflict of interest, they have actually made the sport, you know, a safer place, and certainly somewhere where we don't just disregard these things and carry on as normal. Anyway, let's end the show on that cheery note just for a change. Where can people find you on the internet, Killian?
I'm still at Irish Peloton on Twitter, and my email's mail@irishpeloton.com. And again, I'll send out a few clips and things on Twitch notes. We've mentioned a good few little snippets there from races past, so I'll make sure to check out the Twitch notes hashtag on Twitter.
Yeah, and you know, people will have to wait a week for the next This Week in Cycling History, but as a special treat, you'll be joining me on the Velocast this week because Scott's away. So if you really miss Killian in between the Twitches, there's something special for you this week. But we'll be back very soon with another edition of This Week in Cycling History.